The next case on our calendar today is Joseph V. Livingston versus State of Minnesota. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Council will each have 15 minutes for oral argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Looks like you're ready to roll. If you can just introduce yourself.
I promise you, Your Honor, we're going to get you back on schedule.
Thank you. You can introduce yourself and the party you represent. We would appreciate it, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent Mr. Livingston, the appellant. We have a rather straightforward issue today about whether or not the vacation of my client's conviction and then the ultimate dismissal of his case was as a result of innocence, consistent with innocence. And at this point, I have to apologize to the court. When I did the brief, somehow I missed the Buell, B-U-H-L case, and I didn't cite to it at all in my brief, and it is rather important for this case. So I'm sorry about that. That's at 922 Northwest 2nd, 435, where Judge Hooten of this court for the panel said that, you know, they agreed that consistent with innocence means agrees with innocence. And if I could, I'm just going to make the point, go back to the last case that was argued before you, where we have a stop issue. And if we'd had a stop issue and things were suppressed, but Mr. Livingston had been found with a bunch of narcotics and the narcotics were suppressed, that would not necessarily, and then later it was reversed on habeas, that would not necessarily be consistent with innocence. But here, what we have is a very simple, straightforward step. He was convicted of DWI, hazardous substance, specifically DFE. So the elements are Mr. Livingston drove. He drove in Wright County, and he drove while under the influence of a hazardous substance, that is DFE. The problem is
there is no evidence in the record that he was under the influence of any other substance at the time.
That is correct. And part of the reason for that is that this proceeded by plea. So Mr. Livingston actually pled and said, I was under the influence of DFE. And so no one thought anything about it until the Minnesota Supreme Court, of course, said in the Carson case, DFE is not a hazardous substance because the hazardous substance statute refers to a specific, regulation, and DFE was not in it. So the question isn't whether or not Mr. Livingston drove hazardedly, you know, in a hazard manner. It wasn't. The question is whether or not it was a crime at the time he did it. And innocent, consistent with innocent, has to be consistent with innocence of the crime of which he was charged and convicted. Not all crime. We're not asking if he's been purged of original sin. We're just asking whether or not he has been convicted properly of the crime for which he was charged. And he was not. I sometimes tell to explain this, and I talked to one of my clerks about this. If the legislature passed a law that said you can't wear blue sweatshirts on Thursdays, putting aside all the problems that there'd be with that, and it defines sweatshirt as having a particular weight of cotton material, and someone wore a blue sweatshirt made out of nylon, and the Supreme Court said, no, I'm sorry, that the legislature has defined sweatshirt to be made out of cotton, then the person would not have violated the law because they don't meet an element of the offense. If you don't meet an element of the offense, you are not guilty. I think it's unfortunate, and I don't know how to fix it, that the legislature used the term innocence, because we're not Scotland. We don't have the Scotland. You get three verdict choices. You get guilty, not guilty, and innocent. And so juries don't find people innocent. They find people not guilty. And so I'm not really sure exactly how that gets fixed. But the fact is, Mr. Livingston did not commit a crime. He was exonerated.
Well, I don't know that the legislative, I don't know if the language is incorrect. There's a difference between being found, as built into our law, there's a difference between being found not guilty and being determined innocent. And the statute seems to go further by putting the burden on the defendant to show either a crime did not occur or I am not the one who committed the crime. That's my assumption without getting into the depth of the background is that the Innocence Project and DNA evidence had a lot to do with the development of this law, where individuals are actually exonerated because it's clear the evidence shows they did that person didn't commit the crime.
And here, Your Honor, to use your language, a crime was not committed. The crime of which he was charged was not committed. And unless
he was driving impaired, I mean, would you admit that this fact situation, regardless of how we interpret the statute, was really not what the legislature was thinking about at the time? I mean, he was driving while impaired.
There's no question he was driving impaired. But the question is if the legislature had a law that said you can drive impaired, you can't drive impaired if you've been drinking gin, but you can drive impaired if you've been drinking wine, then if someone's pulled over drinking wine, they're not driving impaired within the meaning of the statute.
So I've got a couple of questions.
Certainly.
Here, can you help us? So 590.11 subdivision 1B1 small I was in fact struck down as being unconstitutional. So the double I talks about ordering a new trial, but there was no new trial. So was there even a section of the statute for the judge to rule? I mean, how do you help us with that?
Well, I believe there actually, it was vacated and a new trial was ordered, and then...
Oh, there was, okay.
I believe that. And remember, I was not Mr. Livingston's defense counsel for his crime.
Uh-huh.
And I see counsel looking through there, and he may have a better answer, and that's fine. But I don't actually know the answer to that.
So. Yeah.
But the way that the one provision was struck down, this actually was...
I think it was just vacated and not... There was no new trial. I think it was just vacated.
But we actually talked about this a little in a prior motion in this case.
Yeah.
About... What's the effect of the fact that this particular portion of the statute was stricken as unconstitutional? But our view was is it didn't make the statute unconstitutional completely, but only as to the people that were in that particular circumstance, which is they can't, because the conviction has been reversed by this court or the Supreme Court or whomever, you can't dismiss it because it's gone. Poof. There's nothing to dismiss. And so that was an earlier argument that counsel had actually raised and that we had addressed. You said you had a couple of questions, so.
Yeah, so the second question, and I'm going to ask a respondent's counsel as well. So the legislature then amended 590.11 and included a definition of ungrounds consistent with innocence. So are we to follow Buell, or are we to follow this new definition?
I can't remember if we filed our petition before or after the modification. So the question's going to be, does the legislature say it's retroactive? And I don't believe it does. So we probably have to follow Buell.
Okay. All right, thanks.
And following up on that, in Buell, the court concluded that that language was ambiguous. Respondent in its brief argues that we should then look to the legislative history to interpret that language for purposes of this case. And as part of the legislative history that respondent cites, it includes a quotation from Senator Latz that the legislation was not intended to cover cases where there are legal issues or legal technicalities or even constitutional questions that resulted in reversal of convictions. So is your position in this case consistent with the legislative intent in terms of the meaning of the language that's at issue here?
Well, first, statements of individual legislators, as opposed to committees and as opposed to how things go, are not necessarily indicative of what the legislature as a whole were thinking. Second, and I tell this to, this is again a line I use with law clerks and mentees all the time, when you say, well, it's a technicality, the law is technicalities, because if we didn't have the law, it would be might makes right. What makes things happen is a technicality. And so I remember something from junior high. In the Prussian system, that which is not allowed is forbidden, but in the English system, that which is not forbidden is allowed. And here, for whatever reason, this is not a technical thing. This is a statutory definition of the crime for which Mr. Livingston was convicted. This is not the stop was bad. This is not, we didn't have anything. This is, he was charged with and pled to a crime that it turns out he did not commit by statutory definition and statutory interpretation by the Supreme Court of Minnesota.
I think what you mean to say is he pleaded guilty. He acknowledged engaging in conduct that itself is not a crime.
Correct. Thank you. You said it so much better than me.
I thought
that's
what you were trying to argue. There's a difference, though.
And so that's the reason why it is not inconsistent with what the legislative history you just quoted here. That is the whole thing here. He was innocent of the crime to which he pled because his conduct did not meet the statutory elements. If there aren't any more questions, I will sit down until possible rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Greg Kreiser. I represent the state of Minnesota in this proceeding. I first want to address Judge Siegel's two questions here right off the bat. And if you look at Judge Tenney's order on January 24 of 2018, paragraph one of his order says the petitioners, and here he makes a typographical error, but petitioners petitioner in petition to vacate the conviction is hereby granted. That's what he did. He vacated the petition. And as far as the argument of whether or not we're under the first I or the double I, I'll be frankly honest. I tried to bring that issue to this court. However, I soon learned from the efficiency of your clerk's office that the state can't appeal a post-conviction action unless everything is ruled against us. So that issue is still hanging out there in the event of a remand and coming back. So I wanted to get that issue here, but under our rules of criminal procedure, I wasn't able to get that issue under whether or not we're here under subdivision I, which is unconstitutional under BAC, or subdivision 2. So we have to go with the district court rule as far as the proceeding under the second double I. But that is an issue still hanging out there that the state, I mean, if for some reason this gets remanded, fully intends on bringing it back.
Can I ask you about the district court's decision? It's consistent with an argument in your brief. And I couldn't find sort of the, I couldn't get my mind around really what was happening. So the district court says on page 3, a reversal of a conviction based on a change in the interpretation of law does not suggest innocence. And I'm wondering whether you agree that that's a correct statement
of law.
I do,
Your Honor.
So what was the change in interpretation?
The change in interpretation here, Your Honor, is that at the time Mr. Livingston committed this offense, it was the law in the state of Minnesota that huffing DFE and driving a motor vehicle was illegal.
It was the law in the state of Minnesota?
As interpreted.
As interpreted by whom?
I think by district court judges at that point.
So district court judges don't establish what law is in
That's
Minnesota.
True. Correct.
So you need an appellate decision or you need something in the statute that supports it. So, and the Supreme Court said the statute doesn't support it. So what was the change from what?
I think we need to follow it. So at the time of charging, Carson hadn't been decided by this court. So between
but
charging
there
and
wasn't
sentence,
any, and there wasn't any precedent that established at the time of charging that the substance was a hazardous substance?
At the time of charging, no. So, charging, there was no opinion from this court at the time of charging. At the time of sentencing, this court had ruled on Carson and said DFE was a hazardous substance.
Right.
And
then he pled guilty. At the time of the offense, though?
At the time of the offense, there was no appellate decision on the point of DFE being a hazardous substance.
Okay, so when the district court said a reversal of a conviction based on a change in the interpretation of the law, there was no basis for the district court to say so because there had not been an interpretation of the law suggesting that that a crime had occurred in this case at the time of the conduct. Am I correct or not correct?
At the time of the conduct, there was no appellate. At the time of sentencing, at the time of plea, yes, there was an appellate.
Okay, isn't our focus the time of conduct?
Well, if there was a time of conduct, this case would have been dismissed and he never would have been convicted, so we wouldn't be here on this.
No, no.
So,
if something wasn't a crime at the time of the conduct, then it wasn't a crime. Is that right or not right? Are you suggesting that something can become a crime at sentencing or just before sentencing? If it wasn't a crime before, at the time of the conduct, that the individual's conviction can stand?
No, it's a very nuanced issue here, and I appreciate your argument here,
that
Judge Ross.
I don't think that's that nuanced.
I think it's a great argument you're trying to flesh out here, Judge Ross. But, you know, at the time he committed this offense, everyone understood, at least, you know.
But there was no precedent.
There was no precedent. It hadn't been appealed.
What do you mean everyone understood? That's the part that's implied in the district court's decision. It's implied in your brief. Yeah. Everyone?
Well, I think at the time of sentencing, definitely.
Who was everyone?
Prosecutors, the attorney general's office. I think as far as the executive branch, I should say that as everyone.
But based on the Supreme Court's decision in Carson, there's no question that it's DFE, did I get the initials right? That isn't a hazardous substance within the meaning of the law, right?
That wasn't a listed hazardous substance.
Right.
Within the meaning of
exactly.
the DUI statute, yes.
And the DWI only applies to listed hazardous substances.
That's what the Supreme Court articulated, yes.
Right. So how is there any question that his conduct was not a crime?
I think it goes back to, again, kind of what the legislature intended here. And at the time he committed this offense, I understand there was no appellate decision dealing with DFE. And the case kind of went and worked its way slowly through the district court system, and they waited for this court to rule on Carson. And when it did rule on Carson, Mr. Livingston then pled guilty.
How does that help your position if the conduct occurred before the decision in Carson?
I think it helps our decision because it shows that the state and the prosecutor, or state and the defense attorney, the defendant and the district court were all proceeding and trying to do the right thing here.
Well, what if everyone on the planet believed it was a crime and was wrong? Just misread. Everyone except for six of seven justices on the Supreme Court who hadn't yet got the question.
Yes.
And when they get the question, they answer it. It's not a crime. So why does it matter if everyone believes it's a crime if the law had not established, if the statute doesn't establish it as a crime and case law hadn't established it as a crime? On what basis would we say that a crime occurred at the time of the conduct in this case?
I can't say a crime occurred. I mean, when we came to the district court, we agreed that the plea should be vacated underneath the decision in Carson.
If there is no crime, how is he not innocent?
I think he's not innocent because he admitted that he drove under the influence of DFE and alleged that the facts...
What is he guilty of then?
He committed the offense at the time. I mean...
Which offense?
The offense of driving under the influence. I mean...
Which is not a crime.
The only evidence in the record of any substance that he was impaired by is the DFE.
That's correct.
And you're agreeing that that's not a crime under the statute?
The Supreme Court articulated that it was not a listed hazardous substance, yes. And we agreed to vacate the plea.
So isn't the argument really that you feel like he's morally culpable because he was driving in a dangerous... I mean, his lawyer said he was driving while impaired, albeit not a crime.
Yes. As later interpreted, yes.
Well, but isn't, I guess that's the rub, as I read the statute, because all that must be shown to be eligible for compensation is either the establishment of innocence or the establishment that a crime was not committed or the crime was committed by someone else. There's no argument that it was committed by someone else. The argument is a crime was not committed. And it sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No.
It sounds like you're acknowledging that a crime, as that term is used in Minnesota, which is a statute, is violated, a crime was not committed.
As later interpreted by the court, Supreme Court, yes. I have to agree with that. With all due candor, I have to agree with that. You know,
how do you prevail? How does the state prevail if a crime was not committed at the time of the conduct of this case, under this statute?
I think because the court's holding here stating agrees with innocence. Does that overturn agree with innocence? And that's really what it comes down to. It comes down to Buell. How is this court going to interpret
it? Why do we even care about agrees with innocence if the conclusion is a crime did not occur? How can you be more innocent than engaging in conduct that is not a crime?
And I get that, you know, and this is the issue that we're dealing with. And I agree with counsel. It is a straightforward issue of Buell. It's up to this court. It really is a de novo standard of review. I mean, I have Buell. That's all this court's given us, really. I mean, we have Carson. We're looking for guidance, really, here at this particular point. And it is an interesting fact pattern, like you raised, Judge Ross.
So go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask you a quick question, the same one I asked appellant's counsel about the amendment to 590.11 that added a definition of on grounds consistent with innocence, and it also allowed people who did not file a petition or for whom the petition was denied that they could still make a claim under this amended statute. So are we still dealing with Buell, or is there a good argument that, in fact, we now have a statutory definition, and we should be looking at that statutory definition.
Thank you,
under the current, which says on grounds consistent with innocence means either exonerated through a pardon or sentence commutation based on factual innocence, or exonerated because the judgment of conviction was vacated or reversed, or a new trial was ordered. And there is any evidence of factual innocence, whether it was available at the time of investigation or trial or is newly discovered evidence.
Unfortunately, I can't have my electronics on in this courtroom because I want
to... Yeah, no,
this,
I don't I mean want, to catch want, you off guard, no, but I, it did strike really me want, as a question.
I really wanted to go into the statute because it has the little site at the end to find out what the session law says when it comes into effect. I'm guessing, because the judge's order, it says it was done in 2019.
Yeah, I've got the old session law.
The district court issued its order in June of 2019, denying this claim. So this petition was filed before this amendment. And I'm guessing, let's assume for argument's sake, that this provision was tied up in a funding bill, so then it'd go into effect July 1. So it would have gone into effect literally 2 weeks after the district court reached the decision. So I don't believe it would apply, but I can't say for certain that the legislature didn't say the day after enactment. So,
yeah, and I don't have the new session law with me. Otherwise, I would.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm sorry for asking such a specific question. I know when not too long ago I was on the other side, I would have hated that question. So my apologies.
No, I wish I could have turned my cell phone on because I want to hit that link right there to find out for you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, not a problem. So I think at the end of the day, this really just comes down to de novo review of Buell and what this court wants to do. I mean, I can't make up law. I can't make up facts. All I can say is what this court has given us before in Buell and what the district court gave us. I would note that I think an interesting point here is that the district court that vacated the plea also found that it didn't do this on grounds consistent with innocence. And I think that has some bearing here. Judge Tenney is the one who vacated this plea, and he's the same judge who said, I didn't do that on grounds consistent with innocence. And I think to some extent that deserves some bearing and some credit on the part of the district court. as it goes through that. You know, is there a standard review on that? No. Is it probably de novo? Yes. So I you know, again, these are the wonderful things of first impression that were dealt with at the state and as the defense attorney. So
this is way off the page, I suppose, but do we know what the legislature has done or what the rules have done with difluorothane since the Supreme Court's decision? I'm assuming that no one in the legislature wants people driving while under the influence of difluorothane.
No. they did it amended back in. I don't know if it was 2019 or 2018.
Okay, so they
one of those August 1 dates, it did get amended back in. I don't know which one, though.
So Carson had a pretty short shelf life then.
Yes. So with that, I guess I gave you the legislative history. I've given you what I can. So it really comes down to de novo review. And, you know, I ask that you affirm the decision of the district court, but I eagerly await your opinion in 90 days. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kreiser, any rebuttal for appellant?
Two items. First, I don't know that it matters whether you follow Buell or the definition, because I think the result is the same. And number two, there was a question about was there a new trial ordered? I will just note that if you look at the Minces, the order that vacated this, I believe, is on 1/24/2018, which is entry number 83. And then entry number 85 is a notice of hearing, which would imply to me that if the court vacated it and then set a notice of hearing, it did put it back into the trial schedule, because it wouldn't have set a notice of hearing if it hadn't done that.
And didn't the district court find in the motion to dismiss that a new trial was effectively ordered?
Yes.
Or in its order on the motion to dismiss, yes. I should say.
Unless there are other questions, my client thanks the court for its time and attention to the matter.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your argument here today. The matter is submitted, and have a great rest of your day. We will now in recess and continue with our non-oral calendar. Thank you.
$3 million.
Good luck.